inside a tiny little box. Welcome into the program. Glad to be with each and every one of you this morning. Glad that I have this opportunity to converse and speak with you as I like to do every single day. We've been trying to do that. We've been trying to make this a daily thing, and by and large, we've succeeded. So thank you for being with us on the program today. Welcome to everybody that is joining us right now on Facebook Live. Thank you so much for your support. Boy, there is a lot of news to get to today. Oh my gosh, this is one of the biggest news days that I can remember in a while, and I just came off of an election day. And I don't know, maybe it seems like there's less news, because even though there's a lot of bells and whistles to cover, you're really covering one thing, which is the election. But now that we're going through the news, this has just been a ridiculous news day so far, and it's only half over. So a couple big things that I want to get to before I get into the news that we're going to give more commentary on. I'm sure a lot of you have heard that there are now 13 confirmed dead in that horrible shooting in Thousand Oaks, California. Originally, the count was 11, and I do believe, and I've been able to confirm this through a couple of sources, that they have moved the death toll up to 13. So that's the number of people that were killed in this shooting in Thousand Oaks, California. And guys, you know my rule. 48 hours. Before I give any commentary, before I give any speculation, 48 hours. I'll talk about the facts. I'll talk about what we know, which right now is not much, that I do not use any kind of tragedy as a political, you know, football, any of that. Don't do any of that commentary until at least 48 hours after the event has taken place. And so all I'll say right now is the raw facts of the story. There was this bar, a place where people typically go to line dance. So it sounds like kind of a country themed place, and they were having their country night. So there were a lot of teenagers, a lot of younger people. I don't know if necessarily there was anyone under 18 that was permitted, but there were a lot of people that were under the age of 21. They said there were a lot of people that come in for country night. They don't drink. They just come in and party and have a good time. And unfortunately, there were 13 people that were killed. And one of the people that died was a police officer named Ron Helas. And I think that this really emphasizes how much our police officers and our law enforcement officials do for us. Goodness knows that there's bad cops out there, just like every other profession, and they're not all perfect, but by and large, they do an amazing job keeping this country safe. And this guy, evidently, according to the eyewitnesses there, they say that he died a hero. And so congratulations to Ron Helas for doing your job, for doing what you were trained to do. There were lives that were saved because of your action, and though he's no longer with us, the man died a hero, and we are certainly appreciative of that. In fact, I wasn't even planning on doing this, but you'll notice, you probably can't see it, but if you look at the cover on my Bible, it has one of my favorite verses, and it's part of the reason I bought this Bible cover, and it has a quote from John 15:13, which is, "Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." And so to be able to be willing to sacrifice your life in the service of others, to sacrifice your life to save the lives of other people, people you didn't even know, is the greatest expression of love, according to the man who did that himself, Jesus Christ. And he would know better than most that that is the ultimate expression of love and Christianity and walking with God. And so we certainly are appreciative of Ron Helas and pray for his family and pray for the families of all the victims in this terrible shooting. We'll talk more about this and talk about the political fallout, but for right now, just want to give you the raw details of the story, let you know what's going on. They don't have a motive for the shooter yet. They're not really sure who the shooter is at this point. They have a suspect, but they're pretty sure that this is the guy, because according to eyewitness accounts, and I say allegedly because I am still a news person, so I gotta wade through the legal jargon. So the shooter apparently did shoot himself. And so after he had committed this heinous act, he wound up killing himself afterwards. So that is the latest. And these details are kind of pouring in, and it's hard to parse through exactly what is accurate and what is hearsay. But these are the facts, as far as I can tell, that I've been able to verify. And if it changes or if there's some issues going on, we'll let you know about that. But right now, that is the story. 13 killed in the bar shooting. Ron Helas was the police officer that died in the line of duty, and the shooter has shot himself. That's really all we know right now. Another news story that is not nearly on the same level but it is something to be concerned about and something that also requires prayers, is apparently Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the most liberal, well, Sotomayor is probably more liberal than she is, but I mean, it's close. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has fractured three ribs. She apparently went home the other day complaining about some discomfort, went to the hospital, and now has been hospitalized to look at these three fractured ribs. Apparently she broke them in her office. I'm not really sure on the details of that, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg has three fractured ribs, and so we certainly wish that she would have a quick recovery, that she would be able to be okay. Goodness knows I disagree with the woman on virtually every issue. I can't stand her judicial philosophy, her idea that the Constitution is some living, breathing document as opposed to being the Constitution that is eternal, that, you know, you read the law as it is written, as it is interpreted, not how you wish it to be. You know, she and I would knock heads on that, but she's still a child of God. She's still created in the Lord's image, and because of that, nobody should wish any ill on her or any harm for her. So as much as I don't want her on the high court, my prayers do go out to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I hope that she has a quick recovery and she's able to get back on the court. I would love for her to retire. I don't see that happening, but I don't want her to be on the court anymore, but I don't want her to go out because something terrible happened to her. And so certainly our thoughts and prayers also go with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, agree with her or not. So finally, that gets to some local news, which is really national news, but it's local because it's happening to one of our own. The big news yesterday, Jeff Sessions has resigned from the attorney general position, which, by the way, Senator Lindsey Graham apparently was right. He was saying in an interview just a couple of days ago during the election coverage with, I think it was NBC. I was watching so many different news channels that night, it's hard to remember which. But Senator Lindsey Graham comes on and he gives a prediction, and apparently he had heard through the grapevine that it was not going to be long after the midterms that Jeff Sessions would no longer be the attorney general for the president of the United States, which, good information, because when he said not long, gosh, it was not long. It was not long at all. And that just went away really quickly. I mean, we're barely 24 hours after the midterm elections, and the other day, this resignation happens. Now, evidently, and this is from some of my sources, General John Kelly is the one that told him it had to be immediate. This is coming from Caitlin Collins. She works inside the White House. She's with our news partners at CNN, and she's also hometown girl right here from Prattville, Alabama. I think she went to Prattville High School, if I'm not mistaken. So anyway, Caitlin Collins doing some really great reporting up there, keeping us up to date on the situation. One of the things that she brought up is that apparently General Kelly told him that it had to be immediate. So Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, requested that he stay at least until the end of the week. And General John Kelly, as per the instructions of the president, said, no, it has to be right now. So evidently Trump was really in a rush to get this guy out of office, which I think comes as no surprise to anybody. Because the reason that I say that is you look at the way that he has dogged Attorney General Sessions over and over again, the way that he's talked about him, the way that he has had issues with the way that he runs his office, which is a really bad look for the president to air his grievances so publicly and to be so public about his problems with the attorney general. It really just is not a good look for the president of the United States to do that. And so because of that, and because you have this whole cloud hanging over Jeff Sessions and hanging over the president, it's not a surprise to anybody that he's being terminated. And apparently, this is, to me, something that's kind of amusing, and it's something that I've been talking about for a while. It's funny to me that the things that Trump is most famous for, he's really not very good at. And what I mean by that is when it comes to being this top negotiator, he's really not great at negotiating. I mean, he didn't write The Art of the Deal. When it comes to negotiating tactics, he typically doesn't wind up doing very well. When he listens to his advisors and talks to them, especially when it comes to things like foreign policy, he does much better. He's just not that great at making deals. And so even though I think that Trump is competent in a lot of areas, I don't think he's much of a negotiator. And this kind of plays into the story that we're talking about right now. He kind of sucks at firing people. He doesn't like firing people. And so it's funny that the guy who got famous on The Apprentice for going, you're fired, I mean, that was his calling card. That was the thing that he did. That was just his, you know, that's when you thought of Donald Trump, that's what you thought about. But the thing is, he really doesn't like firing people. And I'm not just saying this because of Jeff Sessions. If you look back at the FBI director, James Comey, you look back at his former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and there's been a lot of turnover in the White House. And what's hilarious about that is Trump really doesn't fire anybody. What he does is he either has somebody on his staff do it, or what he does is he just leaks it to the media and lets them sort of get it out there, and then they find out. For example, James Comey found out he was getting fired through TV. He was watching the news, and he was it was in the back room of a place that he was actually in front of a crowd speaking, and he saw that ticker go across. I think it was CNN that he was watching, and it said that James Comey had been fired. And so this is the dirty little secret in the White House, is that the guy that got famous for firing people actually doesn't like firing people. And so he had General John Kelly do it for him. And apparently there was the decision made before the press conference the other day, but he ducked a question about it, and then they didn't announce it until after that press conference. And so they didn't actually announce it at the press conference that the president was at. They announced it afterward because he didn't want to talk about it. And so he doesn't only not like firing people, he also doesn't like talking about firing people. And so it's just a funny thing that that's what he's famous for. But anyway, the whole debacle, it really sucks because, to be honest, Jeff Sessions was the best person to be attorney general. I know that the thing that annoyed the president about him is that he recused himself and did exactly what the law required him to do as somebody who participated in Trump's campaign. And if you want the case on why he had to do that, why he legally had no choice, you can go back and look at my podcast at tacticsradio.com. I explain it. I believe the episode is 8/24/18, because that was a couple months ago, which, by the way, that was just back in August. But it feels like an eternity ago that I did that segment. In Trump land, time is compressed, and so days feel like years. But anyway, so when that story broke and when the president was complaining about that in that interview with Fox News, you remember that he was fussing about Sessions recusing, and he should have told him that he would have recused. So I lay that whole case out. I'm not going to rehash it right now because I've already done it. If you want to check it out, if you want my rationale, you can go to tacticsradio.com. Look for the episode that's marked, I believe it's 8/24. It's either 8/24 or 8/26, but it'll be in the description that's what I'm talking about. So go back and check that out. And when it comes to, it is 8/24. I have it written down here. So if you want to know about that, he's had his panties in the twist for a while about the recusal, but really Jeff Sessions had no choice. And that brings me to another issue. I've spoken to attorneys that are in private practice. I've spoken to attorneys that are in the attorney general's office here in the state of Alabama. Every single person that I've talked to about that recusal, when they look at what Jeff Sessions said and they look at the law that he cited that said he had to recuse, every single one of them, without fail, regardless of what side of the political aisle they fall on, say, yep, he had to recuse himself. I mean, people that are diehard, dyed-in-the-wool Trump loyalists have looked at that, and if they're attorneys and they understand how the law works and they looked at the wording of that provision, they said, well, Sessions was right. If you're speaking from a legal perspective, he had no choice but to recuse himself in that situation. And so looking at that and understanding that, like I said, anybody that knows anything about the law at all looks at that situation and does exactly what Jeff Sessions did if you were put in that situation. Now, that being said, the way that this could have been handled better is if Donald Trump had come out and said, look, Jeff, you've done a great job. You've been there for me. You've been loyal to me. You have done everything I've asked you to that you were able to do as the attorney general. But I've got to have somebody that can handle this situation. I've got to have somebody that hasn't recused themselves. And so no hard feelings, but since you're in that position and since you can't oversee this investigation, I've got to go with a different attorney general. I think if he had said that to Jeff Sessions, Jeff Sessions probably would have retired that day. Like, honestly, Jeff Sessions would have resigned that day because he would have understood that and the country would have understood that. But this constant berating him and going after him and talking about what kind of man is this? And he did say that on more than one occasion, attacking Jeff Sessions' character, ironically, for doing the morally correct thing. There's no reason for that. There's absolutely no reason for that. It was overbearing. It's the worst part of Donald Trump's personality, that when someone does something he doesn't like, they're automatically the worst person that has ever lived, because the guy is a man of extremes. And so it's just a real shame that Jeff Sessions, that really put his neck out on the line by endorsing Trump and being the first senator to endorse Trump in the primaries, a decision which I disagreed with Jeff Sessions on. And I think in retrospect, maybe Jeff Sessions would have listened to my warning a little bit more, looking at that with perfect hindsight. But the point in all of that is that when it came to this situation, Trump could have handled it in such a way that it wouldn't look like he is trying to obstruct justice. Because, of course, that's the first thing that the Democrats went to. They started talking about, oh, well, Trump's obstructing justice. He's only doing this because he wants an attorney general that's going to cover for him, that's going to be loyal to him, and that's going to quash this investigation because he doesn't like it. Well, that would just be Democrats doing their usual freak out alarmist routine. But the problem with saying that now is that Trump actually said that's what he wants to do. Trump has actually said on multiple occasions he wants an attorney general that is going to be his wingman, have his back, be loyal to him above his loyalty to the law, and that's the issue that you're running into. And so because Trump has said those things, and because Trump has handled this really the worst possible way any president could, then the fears by the Democrats about him doing this just to get rid of the investigation because he doesn't like it, honestly, that's well-founded. And I don't think the Mueller investigation is going anywhere, and I hope it doesn't go anywhere. I'm not one of these, you guys know this, I'm not one of these guys that is pulling for the president for the sake of pulling against the president. I want the president to succeed, because when the president succeeds, America succeeds. But when you're looking at this, and looking at how he treated his attorney general and the way he talked about it, if Trump had just kept his mouth shut, then you could write all of that off as Democrat fearmongering. But it's not Democrat fearmongering when they're quoting the president and saying that's what he wants in an attorney general. Because at that point, you can prove that that's really what Trump wants. And so from a political perspective, that was just a disaster how he handled that. And regardless of how you feel about Jeff Sessions and his recusal, you can't deny the man has done an amazing job when it comes to the office of attorney general. For example, he has specifically reversed course on several religious liberty cases. Under Obama and Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, the Department of Justice was actually going after people of faith that were just trying to exercise their religion. You can look at the Little Sisters of the Poor case with Obamacare and trying to require them under the law to provide contraceptives, even though they're Catholic and their religion says that you can't give contraceptives. They believe that's a sin. You had the Hobby Lobby case. You had Masterpiece Cake Shop. And they were saying that there were religious liberty laws in various states like Indiana that were discriminating against gays and lesbians just by saying you don't have to participate in a ceremony that you don't agree with. Which, by the way, there's about 20 states that have similar religious liberty laws and nobody went after them. And that predates the Obama administration by a lot. And so when you're looking into that and you're looking at the way that the Department of Justice was operated, Jeff Sessions did an amazing job reversing course on that, actually defending people and defending their religious liberties, and literally going in the opposite direction of the way the Obama DOJ was going. And he's been great on immigration enforcement. If you're looking at administrative arrest, they went up over 30%, and ERO arrest rose by about 50%. And so your enforcement arrests were up by over 50% from what they were under the Obama administration. Anybody that's a hawk when it comes to the border would say that Jeff Sessions did an amazing job trying to take ICE from basically being completely worthless to doing exactly what it was that they were supposed to be doing in the first place. I mean, to a great degree, the Obama administration gutted ICE and made most of their methods ineffective. And you're looking at that, and not only did he whip ICE and Border Patrol into shape, but border crossings dropped dramatically, as did illegal reentry. And so you actually had less deportations under Trump and Jeff Sessions running the DOJ. But part of the reason that you did is because they did such a good job on that, that you had less people crossing the border in the first place. And so there were less deportations because there were less people to deport. And so just an amazing job when it comes to the border. And he also has done wonders on cracking down on sanctuary cities, including filing lawsuits against cities that actively obstruct the laws of this country and trying to keep federal law enforcement from getting a hold of people who cross the border illegally. So by any measure, Jeff Sessions has done a great job with the Department of Justice. I understand that there were some people that were upset that because of his involvement in the campaign that he couldn't act when it came to the investigation, and I understand that frustration, but if you're looking at what he actually was able to do, the guy did a phenomenal job. And to the president, I really hope that he does not get an attorney general that's just going to be his wingman. I don't want him to get another Eric Holder or Loretta Lynch, but just for his side, because that's not good for the country. That's not good for the president. That reeks of corruption. And if that takes place, he will be making a massive, massive mistake. He needs somebody like Jeff Sessions that is going to follow the letter of the law. I'm not saying it has to be Jeff Sessions. I'm not saying that his new attorney general has to recuse himself when it comes to the investigation into Russian influencing the election. I'm not saying any of those things. But whoever he picks needs to have his first loyalty to the Constitution of the United States, not to the President of the United States. And that was true of Jeff Sessions, and that's been true of attorney generals in the past. There are obviously exceptions, and I just named two of them, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch. Their first loyalty was to their boss, to their president, and when it came to be a question between legality and protecting President Obama, they chose to protect President Obama. And in Loretta Lynch's case, also Hillary Clinton. But when it comes to the attorney general, we have to have an attorney general that his first loyalty is to the Constitution and to the laws of the United States, because that's what an attorney general is supposed to be doing. So that being said, Luther Strange actually got into the conversation yesterday saying and tweeting out, and I'll read it here, quote, Jeff Sessions for Senate 2020, hashtag AL politics. This is a possibility. It is entirely possible that Jeff Sessions could, in theory, run for the Senate in 2020. He could run for his old Senate seat and he would run against Doug Jones. Presumably, I assume Doug Jones is going to run again. He's not going to win, but, you know, he'll probably run again. And if you're looking at the midterm elections that just happened a couple days ago in Alabama, that pretty definitively proves that Alabama is still very much a red state. The idea that Doug Jones was a sign that Alabama was going blue, and no, I never bought that from the beginning. I said that the day after Doug Jones was elected. I was like, this is a fluke. It was because there was a very flawed candidate. And so Jeff Sessions could, in theory, he's still eligible. He could run for his old Senate seat in 2020 and be our senator for 6 years after that. That is a possibility. Now, the question is that a good idea? Because honestly, can Jeff Sessions win a primary for the Republicans in 2020? In Alabama, honestly, I don't think so. And I hate to say that because I love Jeff Sessions. And I think that he would be good as a senator, just like he was before he was appointed AG and gave up his Senate seat. But the way that Trump has just savagely and pointlessly attacked him and attacked his reputation and attacked his character, when that first started, when he first started going after Jeff Sessions, I had a lot of callers that would side with Jeff Sessions. I had a lot of callers that were like, look, the president didn't handle that well. We're staying with Jeff Sessions. The longer that went on, the more and more I noticed that callers were calling in and mad at Jeff Sessions and talking about how terrible he was and dogging him. And so the president's messaging, unfortunately, had a pretty profound effect on the opinion of Republicans in the state of Alabama. Now, it shouldn't have, because like I said, Jeff Sessions did exactly the right thing. But nonetheless, and just to give myself a little leeway here, I don't agree with Jeff Sessions on absolutely everything. I don't agree with his stance, for example, on the war on drugs and that kind of thing. But by and large, I do think that he was a phenomenal senator and a great AG. But when you're looking at this from that standpoint, because I'm not saying that Jeff Sessions can do no wrong and you need to be loyal to Jeff Sessions, because to me, it's not about personality. It's about right and wrong. And Jeff Sessions did the right thing. Donald Trump did the wrong thing. And so on this issue, I side with Jeff Sessions. But it's really astounding to me and really sad that I am seeing people that were big fans of Jeff Sessions and were proud for him to be the senator from Alabama, that eventually the president constantly dogging him, constantly talking about how bad he was and constantly fussing about it, did change people's opinions in the state of Alabama. So now, and maybe this changes in the next 2 years, but right now, I don't think Jeff Sessions could win a primary for the Republicans. I really don't. And as much as I hate to say that, I think that's the way that it is. So the question then becomes, is he really the best guy for the job? So let's just say that he could win, because I think if he wins the primary, he probably beats Doug Jones by 20 points. But let's just say that he could win. Is he really the best guy for the job? Because keep in mind, he's going to be 72 next month, which means at the start of his term, if he were to win that election, he would be 74. And when he finished his term, he would be 80 years old. That's not really a problem for me, as long as it looks like he's in good shape and he looks like he'd be able to fill out his term. But somebody that's that age, shouldn't we kind of want somebody that's a little bit younger? Shouldn't we want somebody that will be? What do you think about maybe somebody that's a little bit younger taking the reins? And I thought about a couple people, because who would you get? Maybe Scott Dawson. I think Bill Hightower would really, or Tommy Battle, either one of those two. I don't think that they would necessarily want to run for the Senate. I mean, it's just a feeling that I get in terms of Battle. I think he likes being an administrator. I think he likes being a mayor. He likes being governor. He doesn't necessarily like being part of a legislative body. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe he does want to be a senator. I'm not sure. But out of that group, I think Scott Dawson, maybe he could run for Senate. Just a thought. I'm just throwing it out there. And I really like the sound of this one. How about United States Senator Dick Brubaker? Now, the problem with Dick Brubaker is he's a star here and people know him here, but across the state, it's going to be hard for him to win a statewide election because he doesn't have that much name recognition. But I mean, that guy was one of the best senators we've had in the state of Alabama in a while. Not to say that there aren't other good senators, but I think he was probably the best senator that we had there. And I'm not just saying that because I'm a personal friend of his. But Senator Brubaker would be a phenomenal U.S. senator, and so if he would consider the run, I would certainly support him. Another one that's gotten really popular, Terry Latham, the person that's the chairman for Alabama's Republican Party. I think Chairman Latham would actually be pretty good, and I think that she could win over a lot of people if she decided to run for the Senate seat. I don't know if she'd ever even consider doing that, but you know, it's just a thought. Somebody that's younger, somebody that's a fresher face, might not be a bad idea. So the question is now, what's going to happen with the Russian probe? And that's what everybody's asking about, because now that Jeff Sessions is out, is the president going to bring in a new attorney general that the first order of business is going to let's get rid of the investigation into Russian collusion? So here's what I think is going to happen. Most likely nothing. I think he's going to bring in a new attorney general. The new attorney general, if he has a brain in his head, is going to say, let's just let it run its course, see where it goes. There's no sense in quashing it now. But, you know, we'll have to see. And here's the issue. I think that there are people that are actually waiting for Trump and even baiting him, trying to get him to shut down that investigation. Because if he does, the first thing they're going to do is throw up their hands and like Gladys Kravitz on Bewitched, go, collusion, he's obstructing justice. And so that's going to be the story and the narrative that they run with. Whether it's true or not, that's going to be what they run with. And so if that takes place, I think it's going to be more trouble than it's worth, because I really don't think after all this time that they're going to be able to come up with anything. Because if they had the goods, they would have presented them by now. And it's always the cover-up, not the crime. Keep in mind, when it came to Bill Clinton, he was impeached not because of what he did in the White House, but because he lied about it. And that's really, at the base of it, that's what got him. Even though it didn't get him removed from office, it was a big deal that he lied to Congress. And so, in a similar sense, Trump does not need to do this, because then he'll be brought up on obstruction charges, when he probably would have been fine if he just let it play out. But here's the thing that I want you to watch for. If the Democrats, when they take the House, when they're sworn in and they're, you know, duly elected and Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House and all those horrible things that we're going to see as a result of the elections the other day happen. What happens if the Russia investigation magically just wraps up right then, like a few days afterward? See, if that happens, that is, to me, evidence, because I think that the jury's still out on Mueller. I can't really tell if he's a partisan that's just out to get Trump or if he really is trying to be objective and follow the evidence where it goes. And we'll have to see, based on his findings, whether that's the case or not. But when it comes to this investigation, if all of a sudden this investigation that has been going on for 2 years magically just wraps up as soon as the Democrats take the House and can do something about it, to me, that is a pretty good sign that Mueller was just out to get Trump. So just watch for that in the coming days. If all of a sudden this investigation just magically happens to wrap up, even though they haven't been able to do that for 2 years while Republicans were in charge of the House, if all of a sudden that happens, to me, that's a pretty good indication that Mueller was out to get Trump and he was waiting to end the investigation to where it could do the maximum amount of damage to him. Doesn't necessarily prove it, but it would be strong evidence in that favor, in my opinion. So that being said, we're going to talk about something else. We got to play the clip of Jim Acosta the other day in his exchange with President Trump. Jim Acosta got his press credentials pulled the other day, in case you've been living under a rock and haven't heard about this. So the reporter from CNN that has a long history of having spats with the president, and the rationale behind this was they were saying that he grabbed or inappropriately touched, not in a sexual way necessarily, but just forcefully kind of shoved the reporter or something inappropriate. So I want you to understand that going into this clip, because we're going to show it here in just a second. And I want you to watch him and watch the exchange between him and the president, but also keep your eye on the intern. And I'll let you be the judge of this. Judge for yourself whether this was a little too much, whether Jim Acosta was a little too pushy. So we're going to go ahead and watch that now. This happened yesterday in the White House press conference.
Hundreds and hundreds of miles away. That's not an invasion.
Honestly, I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN. All right. And if you did it well, your ratings would be much better.
If I may ask one other question. Mr. President, if I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am. Mr. President.
That's enough.
Mr. President, I had one other question, if I may ask, on the Russia investigation. Are you concerned that you may have?
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic.
Mr. President, are you worried about indictments coming down in this investigation? Mr. President.
I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN. Go ahead.
I think that's unfair.
You're a very rude person. The way you treat Sarah Huckabee is horrible. And the way you treat other people are horrible. You shouldn't treat people that way. Go ahead.
All right, so you get the general idea. The president and he get in. This is notorious for doing that, too.
Yeah, well, I would just tell him to sit down and we'll get to somebody that knows how to ask a question. He's not nearly as rude as I would be. I mean, being a high school teacher, that idea, and you know this,
sure.
There's no such thing as a stupid question. There are millions of stupid questions.
There are.
The dumbest fallacy that's there ever been, of course there are stupid questions. But if you looked at the entire thing and dissected it, he was much more mannerly than I would have been. Well, I wouldn't have answered the guy's questions at all or wouldn't even have tried.
Well, here's the deal. I think it makes the president look bad. Because if you're a random person that doesn't pay much attention to the news, that isn't following this, that just saw that exchange, you would think, well, the president's being a little rude and he cut him off very quickly. If you understand the context and understand who Jim Acosta is and the way that he treats Trump, and Trump alluded to this in this clip, the way he treats Sarah Huckabee Sanders, even though I think this was premeditated and this was sort of the culmination of a lot of very testy exchanges between him and the president, to the average person looking in that doesn't know all that, it paints the president in a very bad light. And I realize that's not fair, but I do think that that's something that Trump probably should have considered when going through this.
Well, maybe so, but you have to watch the entire thing, and when you watch the entire thing, it wasn't as presented, and that's the fake news that he's talking about and referring to, and that guy had a goal. He loves being in this, the middle of all this, being in the controversy.
Well, now, I'll say this.
Exactly what he wanted it to do.
And I have given this advice to some of my friends, and I'll say this right now on the air. Ladies, if you want a good marriage, and you want to find a guy that treats you right, you find a man that loves you as much as Jim Acosta loves Jim Acosta. Because that dude absolutely loves himself. I think I actually have a picture of it right now. I know you can't see that because you're on the phone here. But let's see if I can pull that up real quick. To give you an idea of how much Jim Acosta loves Jim Acosta, this is a tweet from him with a picture of him staring into the mirror at himself. And that was actually like the background for his Twitter profile for months. I mean, this guy is like the word narcissism comes from the Greek god Narcissus, who was constantly looking at himself, looking at mirrors. And this is basically just a parody of that. Guy just absolutely, he's about as self-absorbed as a person can be. And actually, the irony in all of that, I think, is that the reason those two knock heads so much is because they're both incredibly narcissistic. They're both incredibly self-centered. And they think the universe revolves around them. And because of that, you get two egos that big in the room together. They're going to run into one another.
Yeah. Maybe Nick Saban. I don't know. Anyway.
Saban might be up there with them.
Yeah. Take care.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that, John from Millbrook. But no, it was seriously, though, Jim Acosta does love himself some Jim Acosta. But here's the deal. Is Jim Acosta a self-serving jerk? Absolutely. Has he been unfair to the president and Sarah Huckabee Sanders and quite a few other conservatives in the past? Sure. Can you pull up a clip of Jim Acosta yelling at President Obama? No, because it didn't happen. He always treated him with kid gloves because he adored President Obama. He may be the only other person that I can think of with an ego as big as those three. But anyway, you're looking at this. Jim Acosta is by no means a wonderful human being. In fact, if you're dissecting word by word the things that the president said about him being very rude, being terrible, treating people terribly, I don't think there's a word of that that's untrue, honestly. Maybe it wasn't the best way to handle it, but if you're looking at what the content of what Donald Trump actually said, you're going to have a hard time finding anything that was logically untrue in that particular exchange. And so, if you were going to pull his press credentials for something like that, that to me is a bad move, and here's why. Because now Jim Acosta gets to do his favorite thing, and that is play the victim. That is what Jim Acosta loves to do. He loves to be presented as this fierce journalistic warrior that stands up to the president and gets punished for it, but he does it anyway because that's the kind of guy he is. Again, this is all about Jim Acosta's ego, and nothing is going to feed his ego more than to be able to go on CNN and say, I was the guy that was asking those tough questions, and because Donald Trump didn't like the questions I was asking, he pulled my press credentials because he hates the free press. And that is exactly what Jim Acosta is going to do. So the biggest winner in this whole thing was Jim Acosta. And so because of that, I think that the president probably should have handled it better. You don't pull somebody's press credentials just because they're a jerk, because if that were the case, you'd have to pull most of their press credentials. Now, is Jim Acosta somebody that's probably deserving of that? Probably so. But the point is, doing that just feeds him and gives him exactly what he wants. And so in this particular situation, I think Trump made the wrong move by doing that, because this clip by itself in isolation, whether it's fair or not, makes Trump look like a bully. It makes him look like the bad guy. So we're going to go ahead and jump to this real quick. I want to show you this graphic because CNN released they did a press release right after this to respond. And they said, the president's ongoing attacks on the press have gone too far. They are not only dangerous, they are disturbingly un-American. While President Trump has made it clear he does not respect a free press, he has a sworn obligation to protect it. A free press is vital to democracy. For the 10,000th time, we're not living in a democracy. Anyway, and we stand behind Jim Acosta and his fellow journalists everywhere. So looking at that and looking at what CNN said, if we're to break that down, this is just another classic example of the press overreaching. Because I genuinely believe all the things that I just said about Trump overreaching,
about him being a little too hostile towards the press. I don't like the way that he talks about the press. I don't like the way that he went after Amazon, because the same guy who owns it owns the Washington Post. I don't like the idea of him pulling press credentials, and I was critical of him doing that during the campaign. And it certainly does defy the spirit of a free press as outlined in the First Amendment. However, and I do think that this is important, however, it does not violate the letter of the law, which is what that press release that CNN put out just suggested. There is no obligation in the First Amendment for the president or any other member of the federal structure, whether it be Congress, the Supreme Court, or the president himself, or a member of the president's cabinet. There is no obligation under the First Amendment for the president to be nice to journalists. Furthermore, when Jim Acosta is trying to hang on to the mic there, that is not his microphone. That is the White House's microphone. And not everybody is entitled to access to the White House. I think it's a bad practice. I think it does violate the spirit of having a free press and having people that you don't like as part of that press, and understanding that they continue to hold you accountable. But if we're talking about the letter of the law, if we're talking about what the law actually says and what the First Amendment says, then I'm sorry, there is no obligation there for the president to be nice to journalists. This exchange, even though I disagreed with how it was handled, I mean, as big a jerk as Jim Acosta is, I don't think it was handled correctly. Nonetheless, the idea that this was somehow a violation of the Constitution and Donald Trump is acting against his sworn oath to uphold the Constitution and the amendments that are included in it, that's overreaching. That's not correct. And this is the problem that the press has. They have a legitimate point, they have a legitimate criticism of the president, and then, without fail, they overreach and take it too far. Because if they were being critical of the president and didn't bring in the Constitution or try to suggest that there was some kind of constitutional amendment with this, I would have sided with CNN. But again, as they usually do, the left-leaning media overreaches their bounds, makes a bigger deal out of it than it really should have been. And so that's really the sad thing about the way that this was taken. Maybe it violated the spirit of the law, but it certainly didn't violate the letter of the law. And if you want to talk about someone who actually violated the letter of the law and who actually abuse their power as the president to go after the press, let's look at President Barack Obama. He used the DOJ to get the phone records of Associated Press journalists. He named Fox News's James Rosen a co-conspirator in a North Korean nuclear link and used that to go after him and try to spy on him. He fought to get the New York Times reporter James Risen to testify to the CIA to reveal his sources because some of the information made President Obama look bad, and he wanted to find out who it was that was giving him that information. And I know this is technically allegedly because there was never a direct connection drawn here, but I still firmly believe that this is what took place. He wiped the PC of CBS's Cheryl Atkinson when she was doing work that made the president look bad. So that's an example of someone actually abusing their power and actually defying the letter of the law when it comes to the Constitution to go after the press. And what happened when that happened? The press complained about it for about 10 minutes and then forgot about it. Did Jim Acosta stand up and stand against President Barack Obama when he was doing that and ask him tough questions when it came to that? No. No, not at all. And so this is what people get frustrated about, and this is the reason that people pull for Trump when he has these testy exchanges with journalists and people in the media. They're doing so because they see a very obvious double standard. This is not whataboutism. I'm not trying to defend President Trump. I'm not trying to say that his actions are excused because of what President Barack Obama did. I'm condemning both of them. But if we're comparing the two, President Trump said mean things to a journalist and violated and took his press credentials, which violates the spirit behind the intent behind the idea of preserving a free press. President Barack Obama actually tried to inhibit the press from doing their job illegally and abused his power to do so. So if we're looking at the two, it doesn't really make any sense that the press would be really upset at Donald Trump about this and not be upset at President Barack Obama for actually abusing his power and actually violating the Constitution. And that's the issue that you're running into here. Now, we're going to go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
you messed it up. You're stupid.
All right, for today's Daily Dose of Stupid, this one is a doozy. So, Zahra Al-Salom, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Zahra Al-Salom, the director of diversity at Colorado State University, has assembled a list of offensive phrases to avoid. So, again, we kind of have the speech police coming into play here. This is kind of common practice for colleges and for universities now. They're trying to come up with a list of things that are offensive that you're not supposed to say. Although I will say to her credit, and I do appreciate this, a lot of times these colleges will actually have some kind of ethics board to review this or try to punish the students if they violate these lists or these politically correct instruction manuals, I guess you would call them, if anything else. To her credit, she said, and I quote, "I'm not going to try to change them, but educate them." So as long as it's not forced, as long as you're just writing a manual and saying, hey, these are some phrases that might be offensive and so you might want to avoid them, I'm okay with that. I may not necessarily agree with it. I may not necessarily agree with the contents of the list. But as long as you're not trying to force political correctness down my throat, as long as you're saying, hey, these are things that we think might be offensive and you may want to avoid them, I'm cool with that. I have freedom of speech to say what I want. They have freedom of speech to express their ideas that, oh, that might be offensive. And see, that's what I think we actually should be looking toward. That when we say things, if you disagree with what I say, you use your own speech to say, that's not okay. That's fine. It's obligating people to say something or not say something that I have an issue with, because that is, again, a violation at least of the spirit of free speech. And especially when you're talking about a government institution, which Colorado State University is, I'm really glad that they didn't go that far, that they didn't, as a institution, as members of the government, say, even though we're members of the government, we're going to crack down on your free speech. So that's not right, but I appreciate her at least taking that approach. But here's the funny thing. One of the phrases that she listed that was offensive, long time no see. Long time no see apparently is a big problem because she says that it is offensive to Asians. The rationale she uses behind this is that the phrase was apparently used by British sailors and it was used to mock Chinese people. Now, she couldn't really cite historically where that came from. But she couldn't cite if that was really the origin or not. She just noticed that it was being used occasionally in manuscripts from them. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But the idea that that phrase is somehow poisoned to Asian people. Look, I'm not exactly a world traveler. I've been outside the country once, and it was just a few weeks ago, to the Ukraine. But if we're looking at Asian people, I've got Asian friends, two of my best friends, they've actually been on the show before, Andrew and AJ. They're both part Asian. One's Japanese, one's Korean. And I've been friends with Asians my entire life. I dated an Asian girl one time. I got no problem with Asians. I have a lot of Asian friends. I used to hang out in the student union at Auburn, and the whole place was packed with Asians. I mean, that was the vast majority of the majority of the minority students. I mean, that's correct, but it sounds funny. There at the Auburn Student Union for foreign exchange students. And so when we had those students in there, that was the people that I hung out with. So I've gotten no issue with them. I've had a lot of Asian friends. Not once have I ever heard an Asian person have a problem with that phrase. And it's not because I haven't used it, because I do use it on a regular basis. And so I think really we're grasping at straws, and this is the problem that I have with a lot of the PC culture. We're actively going out and trying to find new things to be offended by. If it doesn't offend people, let that sleeping dog lie. Just let it go. If you as an Asian person do find that offensive for whatever reason and I say it, I'm sorry, just tell me. I'll try not to say it around you. Because that's common courtesy. That's just being polite. I'm not going to rub your face in it. I'm not going to say, no, that's stupid. I'll say what I want. But if we're going to have a relationship and you as an Asian person are offended by that phrase, I don't understand why. But if so, I'll try to refrain from using it around you. But I'm not going to change my entire speech pattern. I'm not going to avoid that phrase altogether because some random person might find it offensive. If it's a word or a phrase that a lot of people find offensive, like a cuss word or a racial slur that has negative connotations, that I'll avoid altogether. But if we're talking about something that is so infinitesimally small, when you're talking about the amount of people that it may or may not offend, we don't even know for sure if it's going to offend them, I'm not going to censor my speech to that level. That's Orwellian levels of ridiculousness. And NPR actually did some research on this in 2014. They tried to look back at the origins of this phrase, and what they actually found, and this is a quote directly from one of their articles, "Today the phrase long time no see is so widespread as a greeting that there's nothing to indicate the term's origins, be they Native American or Mandarin Chinese, and that it's been widely identified with American culture beginning in the early 20th century." So actually what's hilarious about this, when NPR did some research into this phrase, and I didn't even know that they had, but apparently they did back in 2014, when they actually looked into this, NPR, which is not exactly a bastion of conservative thought, they said that actually people associate that with American culture. So, if anything, they're not associating it with Native Americans or the Chinese. They associate it with Americans, modern English-speaking Americans. And so, that was their findings on it. I think that this is much ado about nothing. And unfortunately, that's what most of PC culture is, but at least it gives me good fodder every day for the Daily Dose of Stupid. That being said, let's go ahead and move on to the Chaplain's Report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
All right, Chaplain's Report today, it actually comes from something that we were studying in the Bible last night, and a thought struck me. So to give you a little bit of background on this particular passage, we're in Galatians, and Paul is making his argument to the church at Galatia that you guys are trying to use the old law. You guys are trying to go back to the tenets of the old law. You have a new law. We're not under the law of Moses anymore. And he's having this really hard time explaining to them and trying to get them to understand, why would you even want to go back to the old law? The new law is so much better. Why would you want to keep forcing yourself to try to keep the tenets and the dietary laws and all that other stuff? It doesn't matter. And so he was trying to impress the importance of that on them. And one of the things that he does is he draws this contrast between how the old law under Moses worked and how the new covenant that we have through the blood of Jesus Christ works. And when he draws this parallel and when he draws this contrast, he gives this analogy that really struck me. So here's the verse. It comes from Galatians chapter 3, verses 23 through 26, where Paul says, "But before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Therefore, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ, so that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor, for you are all the sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ." Now, if we're to break that down and look at what it really says, talking about having a tutor under the law, the Greek phrase that is used there, and this was something that would have been common in their culture of the day. If you were a rich person, you hired servants, and at least one, sometimes multiple servants, they were charged with the education and the rearing of your children. Not that the parents didn't have a part to play in that as well, but they were basically like a nanny or a nursemaid. And so that's perfectly fine when you're a child. But when you graduate past that, when you get to the point of maturity where you no longer need that, you don't need the nursemaid anymore. If you're 24 years old, you don't need somebody taking care of you. Well, then the question is, why did you ever need one in the first place? And this is something that Paul anticipates. He's saying there was a time where humanity had to have the old law before the fullness of time had come. And so what the old law did is it put you up in such a way that it restrained bad behavior. But we understand this now just like they understood it back then. Laws do not make people inherently good. They do not make people moral. And so while the old law would keep people from injuring one another, while the old law would restrain bad behavior and act as a stopgap against people breaking down society, it didn't make people moral. And that's really the whole message of Jesus when he's talking in the Sermon on the Mount, he's saying, the law says you're not supposed to kill your brother. But I say that if you're harboring hatred towards your brother, you are in violation of God's law because you're being immoral. You're not breaking the law, but you are being immoral and you're doing something that is against God's will. And he says the same thing for several other things where he talks about the difference between actually committing adultery and lust. And so while the old law of Moses was the law of the flesh, we now have the law of the heart. Doesn't mean the law was bad. Doesn't mean it was incomplete. But you're not supposed to have a nursemaid continue on with you throughout life. You have it for a time. It's a temporary measure. And once you have learned to behave on your own, you no longer have need of that instruction. An analogy struck me the other night that I posted something about it on my Facebook page if you want to see the whole thing. It kind of reminds me of training a dog. When you first get a dog, he's untrained, he's unrestrained, and so if you just let him run loose in the house, he's going to cause a mess and cause problems because he's a dog. And so to restrain that bad behavior, you put him in a cage, you put him in a secluded area where he can't cause that much trouble. And after you've taken the time to train him and to change who he is fundamentally and transform him into this new creature, then he'll behave on his own. He can roam around the house, and he is given more liberty from that cage because now he behaves of his own volition. This is exactly how we as Christians are supposed to act. The law of Moses was there for the children of Israel to serve a specific purpose at a specific time. But now that Jesus has come, there's no need for that anymore. Does it still instruct us? Yes. Is it still written there because it is fruitful for us to understand how God's people worked back then and how God related to the children of Israel? Absolutely. But the point is, you don't continue to have the nursemaid, you don't continue to have that cage, that restrictive law around you when the time for that has already passed. And now we have this transformative law, something that doesn't just keep you from doing bad things, but actually inspires you to do good, to live like God would live, to live like Jesus lived, because that is God, that is how he lived. And so now that we have this example, this law of the heart that changes us who we are, that changes our spirit through the transformative power of Jesus Christ and coming in contact with his blood, now that that has happened, we no longer have need of an old law. And that's the point that Paul is trying to make. We should live like transformed people. We should live like people that have come in contact with Jesus Christ and because of that have become more like him. Stay the course, friends.